Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 394. This week, the questions are taken from Guide 461 on the British S-class submarines of the interwar period and the Wednesday video on the British Pacific Fleet off of Japanese shores. So let's get on with questions. Harry Smart asks, were there any instances in World War II where warships without air cover successfully saw off an air attack without unacceptable losses? Yeah, there were plenty, actually. And I know that might sound like it runs a bit counter to the narrative of total aircraft dominance, but, you know, there's that whole thing of, you know, if every weapon worked the way the manufacturer claimed and if every pilot got every kill that they claimed, then every single aircraft and every single ship in World War II would have been shot down or blown up twice by the end of 1941. So, yeah, there are far more failed air attacks than there are successful ones. But obviously, if an air attack fails, it doesn't tend to get much mention other than, oh, well, yeah, someone tried to bomb or torpedo us and we were fine, as opposed to a big ship explode. That makes a lot of headlines. So, for example, in the series I did on Captain Johnny Walker, when he was operating in the Bay of Biscay with his second support group, they came under air attack several times. Didn't take any losses from that. In the ongoing series we're doing on the career of USS Enterprise CV-6, you'll note a few times off of the Guadalcanal or in the Guadalcanal area, while obviously as an aircraft carrier she usually had a combat air patrol up, she did a few times come under attack from Japanese aircraft when she didn't have a combat air patrol up, or the combat air patrol was off somewhere else doing something. And in a number of those cases, the Japanese failed to do any real damage to her at all. And while a number of Arctic convoys did suffer quite significantly from the attentions of the Luftwaffe, other Arctic convoys came under Luftwaffe air attack and either didn't suffer losses at all or suffered very minimal losses. And there are plenty of instances, for example, on various convoy runs in the Atlantic, but also just general warship operations in the Mediterranean, where ships on both sides, so in the Mediterranean's case, the Regia Marina and the Royal Navy, were attacked by various aircraft from the other side, and nothing much of note happened. I mean, even if you look at Matapan, of course, you have famously the final air attacks that managed to torpedo Vittorio Veneto and cripple Pola, but there'd been a number of other air attacks before that that hadn't succeeded. The Italians definitely didn't have air cover. And when you look through Royal Navy accounts, when the cruisers particularly are operating, and they don't have fleet air arm cover. There might be a carrier out at sea, but it's going to be with the battleships and protecting that formation. And they'd very often get attacked by Italian torpedo bombers or level bombers, and there'd be a bunch of evasion and a bunch of near misses, but no actual fatal damage or significant damage. So, yes, there's plenty of examples, but obviously the fewer the number of aircraft attacking, generally speaking, the less successful they're likely to be. Although, obviously, there are also plenty of examples where one or two aircraft with particularly skilled pilots or good luck managed to score some pretty nasty hits. And equally, while having lots and lots of aircraft tends to mean you'll probably hit something, there are some examples where you have massive air assaults, even without the enemy having or the target having air cover, and they still don't accomplish all that much. Cold Warrior 78 asks, we've seen your videos on treaty-era cruisers during the Second World War. While some nations just cheated on the limits, why did no one plan for serious upgrades for wartime? I'm thinking something like a 10,000-ton compliant hull with adequate armour to protect, say, against 8-inch shells, but only carrying 6-inch guns when launched. The design would then include space and weight to pull the 6-inch out and install 8-inch turrets when the war came. Perhaps it's very complicated, but it could have prevented all the loss of life associated with glass jaw cruisers in World War II, or am I completely off base? There were some attempts to do the kind of thing you described, the Mogami class being perhaps the most famous example, because they were explicitly designed to be triple 6-inch armed, so they had a total of 5 triple 6-inch for 15 guns. So ostensibly, as well as cheating on the displacement limits, but ostensibly they were light cruisers, which meant they were far less regulated than heavy cruisers under the First and Second London Naval Treaties, especially the First London Naval Treaty, which said you could only have a certain number of 8-inch cruisers, but they were explicitly designed in time of war to be able to pull those triple sixes off and put twin eights in And that is exactly what they did. So this is a view of Megami in 1943. And as you can see, she has her twin eights in place. There's also arguably the county class. As I've said before, I have some very strong suspicions that they were designed for, but not with complete armor belts, on the basis of just how easy it was to upgrade them and how well they performed after said upgrade, which is not very common when you're slapping that much armor on something. But the more general problem when it comes to designing a ship, like you say, with the 6-inch guns being able to swap out for 8-inch later on, is that when you look at how the Megamis did it, you need to go through a huge amount of very, very careful design, because you've got to make sure that you have a triple 6-inch mount and a twin 8-inch mount that use exactly the same barbette diameter. You also have to design the complete turret, barbette, interior, shell hoists, etc., to be easily able to be pulled out and swapped over. You probably also have to bank the 8-inch turrets somewhere in a warehouse so that you have them to hand ready to drop in, which is a lot more expense still and requires an awful lot of secrecy. And even the magazine arrangements, because of course the racks for 6-inch shells and 6-inch charges won't fit 8-inch shells and 8-inch charges, so you're going to have to rip all of those out and replace them. And that's quite a lot of design work to do in order to make the ship's kind of dual purpose. And what that's generally going to mean is that there's going to be unused space or inefficiently used space in your as-built design, specifically so that then you can drop in stuff later on. And that might lead to a slight derogation of capability, assuming that you're building your initial ship to within the 10,000-ton limit. For the Megamis, of course, the Japanese also didn't particularly care about the 10,000-ton limit, so that wasn't so much of a problem. You've also got to think about stability and weight, because if you put a whole bunch of additional weight up top, then not only is the ship going to ride lower and potentially submerge its armor belt, but its potential is going to become considerably more unstable, which isn't a good thing. So you either would have to design everything so that the overall weight change is not really all that much, if at all, which is going to be quite complicated, or again, you're going to have to leave a lot of reserve buoyancy in place, which might be pretty obvious to people. And margins were already so tight to get something reasonably effective on treaty-era displacements that that kind of stuff being left over, it just wasn't going to fly in most cases, especially because, of course, most of the people are going to review your ship and then go, oh, hang on, no, this is very inefficiently designed and not particularly capable. They're not going to be in on the secret that you're actually going to swap out for a far more capable vessel later on. I actually think if you really wanted to pull this kind of thing off, you'd almost do it the other way and massively overgun and under-armor the ships in peacetime. So perhaps to ensure you absolutely have the space for either twin eights, you design a very heavy triple six mounting, or if you want triple eights, maybe put in a quadruple 6-inch mounting. You wouldn't really care too much if those triple or quadruple 6-inch gun turrets are a little bit overweight, because the main thing is you're matching to the weight and stability of 8-inch equipment that you're going to be installing later on. And then to fit within the 10,000-ton limit, what you do is have almost no armor. So you'd have maybe magazine box armor, kind of how the counties originally did, and no other armor. And when people question it, you go, well, you know, the magazines are protected, and really these ships are relying on speed and sheer weight of fire with the 12, 16, or however many guns you've got on the thing. I mean, heck, if you've got four gun mounts with quadruple 4-inch, that's 16-inch guns, you could quite make a quite reasonable argument that nothing's going to live long enough to actually shoot back considerably, if at all. So having made your argument that, you know, it doesn't matter if it's a glass cannon or whatever, what you then do is, having proved that you have met your 10,000-ton displacement, but have some fairly significant stability issues because you don't have a lot of weight down low for the armor and you have a fair amount of weight up top with the guns, you go, oh, yeah, kind of like the Sims class, I guess. You go, oh, no, this is really terrible. We've completely screwed up this design. I guess we're going to have a bunch of water admitted into the bottom to stabilize this poor ship, having, you know, possibly deliberately designed the entire double bottom of the ship to be able to be flooded in compartmentalized form. And that way, you just go, look, well, you know, now it's stable. Or possibly the other way around of doing that is because water for the ship's crew and stuff isn't included in standard displacement. You maybe just include the entire double bottom as a whole bunch of sealed pumped compartments. And then you just say, okay, this is explicitly what it is. We're providing loads of shower facilities and fresh drinking water for our crews because, you know, cruisers, they might go off into the tropics for very long periods of time. And so we want everyone to have a nice full, like, 5-minute shower every day and all of this kind of stuff, which would explain the, like, 1,000 tons plus of fresh water that's all stored in the bottom, which also happens to be acting as a huge amount of ballast, which is what keeping you nice and weighed down at what should be your waterline. And then once war comes, as well as, you know, ripping out the 6-inch and putting in 8-inch if you want, because that's going to be a fairly long and involved process, it's a much simpler and quicker process to also go, oh, by the way, we also happen to have these big slabs of armor plate that's going to give you a full 4 or 5-inch thick belt. Quickly, let's bolt them all on the sides. And then everyone goes, oh, but hang on a minute, it's going to be riding really low in the water now because you just put several hundred tons of steel on the side. And you go, aha, but back to normal water rationing for you lot, because we're just going to pump out all those fresh water tanks in the double bottom and suddenly we're buoyant again. Oh, look, it's almost like we planned it all out. That would probably be the way I'd do it. Lonely Lad asks, in his early years, Admiral Rozazvensky served as the head of the small Bulgarian Navy with the rank of Lieutenant Commander, or Lieutenant Commander. What other examples of a relatively low-ranking officer commanding a nation's naval forces are there? There's quite a few, actually. A lot of them from the 18th and 19th centuries, and maybe a fraction from the early 20th, but it's mostly concentrated in the 18th and 19th, particularly the late 18th and early to mid 19th. And a huge number of those officers are actually Royal Navy officers, because you had a whole bunch of countries looking for independence or looking to more fully break away from other countries, depending on, you know, what grade of under the other country's thumb they were already during that time period. And outside of the Napoleonic Wars, the Royal Navy ended up with a surfeit of officers. They had far, far, far too many officers, and men for that matter, than they actually had ships to man in peacetime. Now, men, of course, could be dismissed and expected to find their own employment elsewhere, but a career naval officer who found himself on half pay, if he hadn't been really good with prizes in the war, could find himself in a little bit of a pickle. Or in the case of some, they ran into social and legal issues. And so quite a few fairly accomplished naval officers decided, well, there's an advert in the newspaper, and I'm not kidding, there literally were adverts in the newspaper that basically said, hey, are you an experienced naval officer? Would you like to come and help command a brand new navy fighting against our evil colonial oppressors? Well, apply here. And various British officers, and occasionally French and other officers as well, would just turn around and go, yep, sounds like fun. Hey, this is what I did. These were my accomplishments. Do you think I'd make a good fit? And a representative from that navy will go, yep, that sounds like a good idea. Welcome aboard. Here's command of our entire fleet. Have fun with that. And so Admiral Cochrane, for instance, well before he was an admiral, while he was still but a lowly captain, after having been implicated in some stock exchange shenanigans, ended up going off to South America for a bit. And there he led the Chilean Navy, which is why the second Almirante Latorre class battleship that they built was going to be called the Almirante Cochrane, and then became HMS Eagle. And the Chilean Navy has actually had 5 ships named Almirante Cochrane, including HMS Eagle. And amusingly, again, assuming you include Eagle, 3 of those ships have actually been British or ex-British ships. The second one, of course, being Eagle. The fourth one being a county-class destroyer from the Cold War period. And the current one is an ex-Royal Navy Type 23 frigate formerly known as HMS Norfolk and is now Almirante Cochrane in the Chilean Navy, because, well, the Chilean Navy and a few other South American navies have a wonderful tradition in the last few decades of taking ships that the Ministry of Defense and the Treasury swear absolutely blind cannot be of any further use. You know, they're just rust buckets. They must go to the scrapyard. We can't afford to keep maintaining them. And magically, these South American navies work out how to keep the things in service for decades later. And I mean, if you want to play technicalities, the very first Almirante Cochrane, an ironclad that fought in the War of the Pacific, which is something I have to cover at some point, was also British. It was just British built. It didn't actually serve in the Royal Navy. It went straight into Chilean service. So the only Almirante Cochrane in Chilean service that wasn't actually a British ship in some way, shape or form was the third one, which was a Fletcher class destroyer. And then having commanded the Chilean Navy, he went on to command the Brazilian Navy and then went off to lead the Greek Navy as well before he went back to the Royal Navy and finally got a promotion to Admiral. So generally speaking, if you want to find low-ranking officers from major European navies in command of or in very senior positions of command in other navies that are relatively new and relatively small, just look at basically any country that gained its independence between about 1750 and 1910 and has a navy or had a navy at the time, and you will almost certainly find several low-ranking European officers cosplaying as admirals. The man formerly known as Commenting Is What I Do asks, you mentioned that the S-class design initially had ASDIC. Did that make it into the final design? And how useful would such active sonar be to the submarine in World War II? So there was a bit of back and forth about it, because of course ASDIC did take up, especially in some of the earlier systems, a relatively large amount of space that could be used for other things, and it added a bit more cost to the subs. But eventually they did settle on, yes, okay, we will have ASDIC fitted. The slight complication is that depending on when in the production of the S-class you're looking at, different S-class carry different ASDICs. So the earliest S-class carry type 118s. Later S-class, usually third batch, carry either 129ARs or I think it's 138s. And that's further not helped by the fact that some of the earlier S-class, which survived long enough, would on occasion get retrofitted with newer ASDIC systems. And of course, an ASDIC being a sonar system, you've got the passive or listening mode. So that's got obvious uses for, you know, listening to things like the torpedo runs and explosions and things like this. But the Royal Navy held that ASDIC in submarines could have a number of different uses. Firstly, of course, you could use it for training because it meant there was yet another platform on which people could be trained on ASDIC, which was quite useful, even if those people then only went on to use it on surface ships and destroyers and so forth. You could also use it to map out what was ahead of you. So if you were approaching, say, into a harbour and the enemy might have put block ships down and it might be too dangerous to pop your periscope up and look for some, you know, semi-submerged masts, or they might have done the sensible thing and, you know, just cut the mast down so you can't see the block ship from the surface, well, the sonar or the ASDIC pinging away, you'd be able to go, oh, hang on, there's a big object right ahead of us. Maybe we shouldn't run into it. It could also be used for underwater warfare, for targeting enemy submarines. And as you'll have recently heard, hopefully if you watched the U-class video, the Royal Navy was actually thinking about hunter-killer type submarine operations on a fairly continuous basis from late World War I all the way through the interwar period and into World War II. And, of course, you could also use it to look for surface targets, although it did depend on where exactly the sonar was, because, of course, modern sonar is bow-mounted. It can look up, down, left, right, wherever, whereas some of the early ASDIC systems, they popped out from underneath the submarine, which meant you also couldn't use it if the submarine was obviously resting on the seabed, but that imposed certain limits on what kind of surface targets you could detect and how far away they had to be, and obviously that would also be relative to how deep you were. Brendan Buersdorf asks, there is an Imperial Russian submarine that was designed to run off compressed air underwater called the Pokhtovy, possibly. There is very limited information on this vessel, but I'm very curious how effective this type of air-independent propulsion was. Yeah, so this is the sub. It's the one up front in case you hadn't guessed, because there is a slightly larger sub just behind it. And in the late 1900s, the Russians, the Imperial Russian Navy, that is, they designed this thing, and it was actually a fairly clever idea, because they looked at existing propulsion systems and went, well, if you've got an internal combustion engine for running on the surface, that's great. But then if you need to run the thing on batteries underwater, because obviously fumes are a problem, then you are going to end up with an awful lot of space devoted to your propulsion system. You're going to have your diesel motor, your electric motor, and all your battery storage. It's just a bit of an annoyance, especially if, you know, as submarines get larger, you have to have dedicated internal combustion engines which are driving the charging elements for your batteries. So they thought, well, how about we just have the one engine? And in being the 1900s, they decided they're going to have a petrol-driven engine rather than a diesel one. And you might be thinking, well, hang on a minute, then you're going to run out of oxygen very quickly on the boat as it, you know, dives. And yes, this would be true, except, as Brendan Wurstorff indicated, they had this genius idea of, instead of having an electric motor and a ton of batteries, they're just going to have a bunch of high-pressure air tanks. And of course, a submarine already needs high-pressure air tanks for the whole, you know, diving and coming back up again bit. So having more of them was fine, you know, relatively easy to do. And the idea was that if you have this very, very compressed air, you could just gradually feed that air into the petrol engine, and therefore the petrol engine could continue to run without, you know, eating into the crew's actual air supplies. And for the time period, I would say it kind of mostly worked. I mean, you didn't have a huge underwater range or endurance, but you had a reasonable amount for a mid to late 1900s submarine. There's certainly, you know, diesel electric or petrol electric submarines of the period could go a little bit further underwater on their batteries, but you could get a reasonable turn of speed out of it underwater, because of course you could use just your main drive engines. However, there were two rather major problems with this, apart from the relatively short underwater range, and one smaller issue. The smaller issue was, of course, the fact that once you had exhausted that air supply, you had to head back up to the surface pretty sharpish, and then you would have to run your engines for quite a while, because not only are you motoring along on the surface, but you're also having to pump air back into your high-pressure air canisters so that you can dive again. The two bigger problems, though, were obviously, as anyone who's worked with any kind of compressed gas knows, as the pressure inside the vessel drops, that vessel gets a lot colder. And so, you know, for example, if you're using compressed air very rapidly, you can even get ice forming on the outside of your compressed air cylinder or compressed CO2 or whatever, which, yeah, that can be quite interesting. And internally, you can also get condensation. Now, that's not too much of a problem if you're using a high-pressure air tank to blow air into, say, a ballast tank, because, you know, a little bit of condensation, well, it's water, there was already water in there, it's just going to get kicked out with the rest of the water. Fine, not a problem. However, getting a bunch of water into your petrol engine, yeah, anyone who's flooded a car engine can tell you why that's a bad idea. And the other problem that a lot of people probably foreseen is, well, there's still exhaust gases from a petrol or indeed a diesel engine. And yeah, that was the other problem. People look for the wake of a torpedo to say, hey, look, there's a torpedo coming for us, which is essentially the exhaust gases of a torpedo. And when this submarine was going around, it was trailed by a bunch of bubbles. So people would go, oh, I wonder why there's a bunch of bubbles following us. Maybe there's a submarine at the other end of it. Maybe we should throw some depth charges at it. So it kind of compromised the stealth aspect a little bit. So, unfortunately, in terms of effectiveness, it was a good idea, but not really a viable one going forward. The interesting thing, of course, is that if somebody had read up on that and decided to follow up with that, potentially somebody like the Imperial Japanese Navy could have designed a submarine that worked on a similar principle, because, of course, they had pure oxygen for their long launch torpedoes and various other things. And obviously oxygen normally in the atmosphere is around 21%. So you get a little bit under five times the actual amount of oxygen if you're using pure oxygen, and therefore considerably more range. Also, your exhaust product would be mostly carbon dioxide, and carbon dioxide dissolves very quickly into water. So much like the long launch had little to no wake, your submarine powered by compressed air driving into either the diesel motors or petrol motors, obviously in World War II, probably more like diesel motors, they would have very little to any wake. So the stealth element would be maintained. However, you would still have some issues with potentially condensation, depending on how regulated and how dehumidified the oxygen was when you pumped it into your pressure tanks in the first place. Of course, you also do have the problem of it. You now have a bunch of extremely high pressure tanks full of pure oxygen, which is an incredible fire or explosion hazard if you develop any kind of leak, either just generally or because, say, somebody's depth charging you. And finally, the other major problem would be that once you've used up that oxygen, how are you going to get it back? Now, of course, we do know that some Japanese ships did have oxygen producing plants on board, but then not only have you got your pure oxygen tanks in there, which, to be fair, might take up less space and weight than your electric motors and batteries, but you've also now got to have your oxygen producing plant on board, and that has then got to run while you're on the surface to produce enough oxygen to pressurize your tanks to allow you to use your main drive motors underwater, and so on and so forth. So it could work, but I can see there potentially being some issues surrounding it, especially in case of both recharging, because especially in marginal cases where you might need to just, if you're using diesel electric, you could get a little bit of power and then dive. It might not work so much if you have to fire up a full-on oxygen cracker system, as well as how much weight and space that thing takes up. And also, of course, when you're using an electric motor, if you want to go really slowly or you just want to drift, you can just turn the voltage down or stop and preserve a good chunk of your charge. Whereas with a diesel drive or whatever, you can only rev down to so much before it's going to choke and stall out. And of course, I mean, not so much perhaps in World War II, but maybe later on you'd also have the issue that you would be producing somewhat more noise if you were running diesel propulsion rather than electric motors. Anson Ellis asks, with and without the benefit of hindsight, how should the British have built their post-war carrier fleet? Scrap everything and build the Malta class, update the Implacable class, or what? Okay, so without hindsight, i.e. just operating with the information to hand at the end of World War II, there are a number of different paths that they could have gone down. The path I would have gone down, certainly if I had been in the Admiralty's shoes in late 1945, would have been to argue, okay, look, what carriers have we got? Obviously, things like Furious are going off to the breakers pretty quickly. But in terms of major carriers, we've got the Implacables, we've got the Illustriouses. We've also got the various 1942 light fleet carrier program carriers, so the Colossuses and the Majestics. We've got Audaciouses under construction, and we've got Centaurs under construction. Now, from those, we know the Illustriouses have been very heavily war-worn. They've almost all of them have taken fairly significant damage in the Mediterranean. So, honestly, yeah, they're not that old, but they are very battered. They could be made to continue fighting on, but they are going to need some fairly heavy and expensive refits later on. And honestly, they can't carry that many aircraft. Sure, we crammed a bunch in the Pacific, but especially as aircraft get bigger and heavier, they're fairly limited. The Implacables, okay, there's an argument for keeping them around. They're big, they're expensive, they're pretty new, fine. But then we've also got the Colossuses and the Majestics. Now, some of those might make useful stand-ins for the minute, because they've got a decentish air wing, they've got fairly nice hangar sizes, which is another problem with the Illustriouses. But ultimately, we did design these things to only last a few years. Ironically enough, some of those would go on to last more than 50, but never mind. At the time, I don't know that. And they have limited air groups, but still air groups that actually are similar to an illustrious class. So my argument, without hindsight, would be, look, let's get rid of the illustriouses. And instead, what we'll do is we'll keep the implacables around for the minute, see if something can be done with them, because it would be a shame to waste all that money quite so quickly. We'll keep building the audaciouses, because they're kind of the next generation successors to the implacables, really. The Malters have been cancelled. Okay, can't do much about that. But we do have the Centaurs under construction. And originally there were 8 Centaurs planned. Only 4 of them actually got finished. But I'd look at the Centaurs and go, well, hang on a minute. The Centaurs have a 50 aircraft capacity. They're kind of a hybrid between the 1942 Light Fleet Carrier program and Full Fleet Carrier in terms of design durability. And they've got much larger hangars. So at that point, I would say, okay, let's have our fleet centered around the Audaciouses, whether we build 2, whether we build 4. Ideally, we build 4, but if we can only get 2, fine, we get 2. And let's keep going with the Centaur class program, because that'll give us 8 carriers, each of which, at least at the start of things, can carry 50 aircraft. That's a pretty decent air group. And then we have either 2 or 4 Audaciouses for our big fleet carriers. As I said, we're keeping the Implacables around. We're going to see if we can refit those to full modernized versions. And if we need carrier numbers to keep up in the interim while we produce the Centaurs, well, that's what the Colossuses and Majestics are for. But let's look at selling those off, as was historically done with most of the Majestic class anyway, as quickly as possible to other people who might find a use for them, obviously allies, which would be quite handy. And that way we get rid of most of our wartime deadweight. We renew the Royal Navy's carrier program, mostly pretty much around Audacious and Centaur class hulls. And we might get something out of the Implacables. And, you know, if the design study says this is going to be too expensive or it's not going to work, we can still use the Implacables as training carriers for a while, get some use out of them until they have to go as well. With full benefit of hindsight, you would never cancel the Malter class. So you'd build the Malter class, you'd build the Audacious class that gives you 4 and 4 in full. Almost immediately get rid of the Illustrious class. Keep on as many Colossus and Majestics as you need to keep up hull numbers and flight decks while also hawking them off to other people. The Implacables also would be kind of placeholders, with the idea of taking them out of service in the early to mid-50s. And then I would also pause Centaur class construction. So I would still want my 8 hulls, but I'd pause at 4. And I would use the Audaciouses as kind of a test bed, because timeline-wise, it would fit almost perfectly. So you'd have whichever Audacious class is the most advanced. Okay, that's getting completed as a through-deck carrier, but it's almost immediately going to be going back in. After trials, working up, confirming everything actually it still functions properly, it's going to be going straight back in to be rebuilt with an angled flight deck. And then we've got the next most advanced of the class, which is partially constructed, and we're going to pause construction on that for while the first one gets refitted to an angled flight deck, because the idea is we're going to complete the second one as an angled flight deck carrier from commission. Obviously, it's already partly constructed, but we're going to learn more about how to do that from the refit of the first one. And then the last two, which theoretically either haven't been built or very minimally be built, we're also going to hold on them. And the lessons learned from the first two will be fully applied to the last two, and those will then be built essentially keel up to a modified design, which is full angled flight decks right from the beginning. I would then probably list the first two Audaciouses as potentially available for sale to other powers if they want in maybe the late 50s, early 60s, after we've got some use out of them. And then the second batch, the second 4 Centaurs, would be built using, again, those same angled flight deck lessons. So the first 4 would be kept around for a bit, and essentially the whole of the Colossus and Majestic class would be sold off fairly quickly as these newer carriers start to enter service. The first 4 Centaurs, which which would be through deck, straight through deck, no angle flight deck, could potentially be refitted or could be used as repair carriers, support carriers, amphibious assault ships, basically things that don't really need an angled flight deck. But then that would give me four angled flight deck Centaurs, two, possibly four Audaciouses, but probably, let's face it, two, because we'll probably want the second two. They'd be better to keep around. As I said, the first two we can sell off to some, maybe give one to Australia, give one to Canada. And then once we've learned all we need to know about both building from the ground up with angled flight decks and converting them, so by this point we'll be talking about maybe the mid-50s, mid to late 50s, and we now have a fleet that, for the minute, has four Audaciouses and four angled flight deck Centaurs plus the other Centaurs in it, that's when we take the Maltas in and start upgrading them to full angled flight deck arrangements. And essentially, as those Maltas start to come back out in their fully refitted configuration, that's when we release the first two Audaciouses to hopefully Canada and Australia. Because up until that point, as they did historically, they'll be operating Majestic class carriers. And then we could go, well, hey, look, you know, you've had 10, 15 years operating our light fleet carriers. How about you have a full fleet carrier now? Yay. Now, granted, that does mean in the late 50s, early 60s, the Royal Navy has six fleet carriers, including four supercarriers and potentially up to eight Centaurs in a mixture of repair and assault roles and actual small carriers. And yeah, okay, having 10 full angled flight deck carriers, including four supercarriers, is perhaps a bit ambitious for the Royal Navy at that stage, but it means we've got plenty of essentially ablative armor, because my key objective at that point is to keep the four Maltas going. So whenever you get revisions for, you know, people say the Treasury going, oh, we need to cut spending, we need to cut the Navy budget, et cetera, et cetera, I can sacrifice in increments all my other carriers to keep the Maltas going. Essentially, other carriers get shifted down a notch. So let's say the Audaciouses are acting together with the Maltas. The angle flight deck Centaurs are my secondary theater carriers. And then I've got my straight flight deck Centaurs, which are my assault carriers and so forth. Okay, fine. Then let's say at the end of the 1950s, we sell off the straight through Centaurs. The angled flight deck Centaurs now become my helicopter assault ships. The two Audaciouses become my support vessels and secondary carriers, and the Malta stays the primary fleet carriers. And then let's say end of the 1960s, oh no, there's another set of budget cuts. Well, I can start sacrificing maybe two of my angle flight deck Centaurs, and now I've kept maybe two of them, maybe none of them, but now the Audaciouses have moved down to being my assault ships and support ships, and the Maltas are still there as my primary fleet carriers. And then at the end of the 70s, and they're like, oh no, we must still cut budgets. Okay, fine. Whatever Centaurs are left and the Audaciouses can go. But guess what? Rolling on into the 80s, I still have my four Maltas. And yeah, that's might prevent the Falklands War just by them existing. Because I don't think the Argentinians are going to want to mess with four Maltas packed with Buccaneers and Phantoms. PH89787 asks, theoretically, despite being worn out after D-Day, could the old battleships of the Queen Elizabeth, Revenge and Nelson classes be refitted and gradually join the British Pacific Fleet as a bombardment force in time for the Battle of Okinawa, both so that the King George V don't have to detach from the carrier screen and to provide backup for the US Navy standard or older battleships whenever one of them got damaged and needed to be rotated out? Theoretically, yes. Practically, not really. Because, well, the Revenges definitely, and Malaya as well, were really quite worn out in the post-D-Day period. Rodney, if she'd had a significant refit, would have been all right, but she did need a significant refit. Nelson was in a much better state, and Nelson was actually being considered to be refitted and sent out to the Pacific. And of course, both Queen Elizabeth and Valiant had been out in the Indian Ocean immediately prior to the British Pacific Fleet becoming a thing, along with Richelieu and Renown for that matter. But they didn't have Valiant anymore because she didn't fall over in dry dock. A dry dock fell over and thus she fell with the dry dock and that kind of ruined her. But yeah, the Revengers are definitely far too old. But the main thing is that the British were massively consolidating the Royal Navy as the war in Europe wound down. But based on their experience both in the Indian Ocean with the Eastern Fleet and as well as reports from the US Navy, they realized that you needed massively upgraded anti-aircraft suites, even more so than they'd had in late war Europe. And you needed a whole bunch of other things like improved ventilation and attempts at air conditioning because you're going to be operating in the Pacific. And so they started up a cycle of refitting ships ready to go. Obviously, the King George V's, as the modern fast battleships, made the most sense to send out first. But you had Richelieu and Renown, for instance, both of which are also fast capital ships. They obviously, the French probably would want Richelieu back at some point fairly soon. But certainly Renown would have been a much better candidate to send out because she could have kept up with the Carrier Task Force quite easily. Then after Renown, it would have been Nelson, Queen Elizabeth, then maybe Rodney if they refit her, as I said. But even before all of that, you've got the other King George V to come, who needed a quick update and refit before they got sent out. And eventually all King George V would make it, just not all in time for the major part of the British Pacific Fleet's activities. So I think theoretically you could have rushed Queen Elizabeth, Richelieu and Renown back out to be a bombardment force. Although of those, as I said, Renown and Richelieu can actually keep up with the fleet. So at that point, Queen Elizabeth is kind of your only older, slower vessel. But the priority, and I think rightly, went to getting the modern fast battleships up to speed, ready to go. And if the war had gone on into 1946, then yeah, sure, probably you would have had Renown, Queen Elizabeth, Nelson all show up at some point, but only after the four King George V's were already there. Patrick Donnelly asks, I need your help to win another argument. If a ship was damaged to the point where it needs to be scuttled, does that mean the ship that inflicted said damage gets the kill credit? I ask as the sunk or scuttled argument has been popping up with the loss of Akagi, Kaga, Hiryu and Soryu. Side note, have you played the new update for Task Force Admiral? The latest update where Task Force Admiral moves beyond Coral Sea, I haven't played yet, but it is on my short list of things to play when I get some time. Now, in terms of the sunk versus scuttled argument, my general perspective is that you need to be consistent. And so, you know, if you want to make an argument that a ship that is scuttled by its own crew, fine. But you need to apply this across the board to all ships that were scuttled in action, or, and this is the view that I tend to take, if a ship was eventually scuttled by its own side, but the reason for the scuttling was that that ship had been fatally damaged by the enemy, and the ship was going to sink anyway, but to make sure that the ship went down somewhat quicker, or just because national pride reasons, the side that owned the ship in the first place decided they were going to assist it to the bottom, either internally or externally, because of course you can scuttle a ship internally or you can just fire torpedoes and shells at it, then that really counts as a kill inflicted by the enemy, because as I said, the ship was going to sink anyway, one way or another. All you did was possibly help it to the bottom a little bit quicker. Because if you start picking and choosing and saying, oh, well, yeah, this ship was scuttled in combat, but that counts as a scuttling, and this ship was scuttled in combat, but that counts as a kill for the other side, now you're just cherry-picking based on arbitrary criteria that presumably you're making up to make yourself feel good about one particular ship or another, which is a completely nonsensical way of doing things. And if you argue that any ship that was scuttled by its own side counts as a scuttle and not a kill, then you end up in the slightly absurd situation of the Battle of Midway being the first really big carrier battle of the Pacific War. Obviously, you have Coral Sea beforehand, but obviously Midway involves considerably more carriers. And therefore, technically, by that criteria, carrier aircraft didn't sink anything at Midway. And you might think, well, hang on, that's absurd. Well, yes, it is absolutely absurd. However, you've got to remember, Yorktown was finished off by a Japanese submarine, and all the Japanese carriers were sent on their way to the bottom by scuttling by their own side, by destroyers firing guns and torpedoes, mostly torpedoes. So by that count, the only thing that the Americans actually killed was Mikuma the following day. Now, of course, that is, as I say, completely an absurd position. Every decent textbook and history book written about the Battle of Midway will tell you that Akagi, Kaga, Hiryu, and Soryu were all sunk by American aircraft. But effectively they were. It's just the Japanese put the final rounds into them. And, you know, you could go on to list all sorts of other examples. I mean, by using that same ridiculous standard, the Japanese didn't sink Lexington at Coral Sea because she was eventually put under by a US destroyer with its torpedoes. So no, I tend to view that whole argument as fairly absurd, at which point, if a ship has been battered to the point of sinking by enemy action, if the side in question decides, well, we're going to scuttle the ship to help it on its way, that's still a kill to the other side, regardless of anything else. And yes, whereabouts, that means Bismarck was sunk by the British, even if the Germans managed to set scuttling charges, which in and of itself is somewhat questionable. Wienwe asks, given that the Finnish coastal defence ships Väinämöinen and Ilmarinen were not really meant to be fighting on the high seas to begin with, and given the meagre Finnish defence budget in the interwar years, would it have been better for the Finns to build 3 or 4 big gun monitors for use as a sort of mobile coastal artillery instead of the 2 Väinämöinens? Well, to a greater or less extent, the Väinämöinens were supposed to be mobile coastal artillery. They were never designed for, you know, deep water work. But I think that there's a couple of key differences between them and monitors. So firstly, one of the things that's most immediately obvious looking at the Väinämöinens is that massive central mast. And that's because they need the rangefinder and fire control systems to allow them to fire at long distances. If you go with a monitor, well, you may encounter even more stability issues than the Väinämöinens did. Additionally, as you can see, they use their superstructure to have some superfiring secondaries, and secondaries as a whole, as well as some crew accommodation and the command positions. If you go with a monitor, so basically an armoured raft with a very low freeboard, not only are you getting rid of the ability to have the lower-mounted rangefinder, you can see they're just above the conning tower, you also can't really do the superfiring secondaries, which means you're going to have to concentrate secondaries on the side, and you don't have that higher command position, you don't have that accommodation, so the ship's going to be even shorter range, essentially kind of maybe a day or two sailing possible, because there's just not going to be accommodation for people to spend more than a night in an emergency aboard. And it's going to be harder to conduct command and control, which especially in an area with lots of low-lying islands and rocks and stuff, you do need some higher observation as well. And while the Väinämöinens aren't going to be breaking any speed records anytime soon, there's also a degree of seakeeping to bear in mind. If you're going to move at 15, 16 knots, you do need a degree of freeboard. If you went with the monitor approach and you tried to move at that kind of speed, you're just going to have water cascading over the front all the time, which is going to massively slow you down and cause no end of problems for crew habitation and such like from leaks, etc. So given their size, I think the Väinämöinens are, and obviously therefore the budget restrictions, the Väinämöinens are pretty much about as close as you're going to get to what Finland needs. If you went with perhaps some cheaper monitors with a similar armament, you would essentially have to look at, rather than basing them from one central point, you'd have to look at having multiple bases and essentially base them out from the areas you wanted to defend with some ashore accommodation. And then when there was a threat, they would just man their crews, sail out, fight whatever it was they needed to fight, and then go back home again. You wouldn't be able to conduct anything like a multi-day patrol. And yes, I know there was a US monitor that managed to cross the Atlantic. The crew basically wanted to murder the captain afterwards, and they nearly suffocated themselves. That's not a good example. The Rogue Chief asks, it's been nearly a year since your Leviathan April Fool's video, and it remains one of my favourite specials from your channel. I've been thinking, How well might an amphibious warfare version of HMS Leviathan fare off Port San Carlos during the Falklands conflict? Well, I mean, assuming that for the sake of argument, you know, I'd extended the rather ridiculous scenario even further and gone, okay, yeah, fine, the Royal Navy's going to keep Leviathan around as an amphibious assault vessel. So that would mean that by the time of the Falklands conflict in 1982, she'd be 123, 124 years old. That would be one heck of a career. But the slightly weird thing is that her flight deck length in her final form, as seen here, would actually be similar to the flight deck length of HMS Hermes, the Centaur-class carrier, which was the larger of the two carriers present in the Falklands. So if we were to hypothetically assume that she was kept around for whatever reason, I mean, I don't think she's going to get an angled flight deck, to be perfectly honest. Maybe a very, very small one, the way that the early refits of the Audacious class had. But given the budgetary constraints of the post-World War II Royal Navy and the fact they spent most of their money on Victorious, I don't think there would have been the budget to give her much more than just maybe a basic angled flight deck overhang rather than significant rebuilds of the hull. And yeah, if she's being used as a helicopter assault vessel, it doesn't matter quite as much. She is, however, still going to have a fairly substantial amount of flight deck space. And who knows, someone might have stuck a ski ramp on the bow just in case so she could operate Harriers, which would be absolutely hilarious. But, you know, if we're going to do this, fine, I'm going to come up with a quick hypothesis. So at that point, instead of being derated into reserve because she's not thought suitable for the Pacific, then instead, at the end, toward the end of World War II, they decide, okay, Leviathan's not really a frontline ship anymore, but she could make a useful supplement to HMS Unicorn, so as a repair and support carrier. But in order to save weight so she can carry more aircraft and various new fixtures and fittings, they take off the heavy anti-aircraft battery, which you can see here, and they replace it with a series of quad 40mm Bofors, because saves weight but still gives her a degree of anti-aircraft protection. Fantastic. She goes off, doesn't arrive in time for the Pacific, and is then taken offline for a little while and then turned into a helicopter assault ship in the early 50s as kind of a nice prototype that can run in the background without disrupting main fleet operations. She's then put into reserve at the end of the 1950s instead of being turned into a museum ship. But because of her history, they can't quite bring themselves to scrap her. And also Brunel's construction means that she just keeps on trucking. So she gets brought out occasionally for use as a test vessel, essentially to test new aircraft for the Royal Navy, helicopters, etc., etc. And she's also useful to be brought out of reserve for use in amphibious warfare training exercises, again, without disrupting the main fleet. But in general frontline service, she is replaced by various Centaur-class carriers as time goes on in the sort of intended forward assault role. But what this means is that by the early 1980s, because she's been popping in and out of reserve for the past few decades, she's still actually in vaguely workable condition, but she was taken out of service in the late 70s alongside Ark Royal, but then put into the reserve fleet again, essentially preserved, waiting for a decision to be made as to whether to make her finally a museum ship. Then the Falklands conflict breaks out, and they go, oh, hang on, that's a third flight deck. Yes, it's old, yes, it's slow, but it is a flight deck, and it technically can run Harriers, quickly improvise a ski ramp. Off she goes down to the Falklands, loaded up with various helicopters, which actually is going to make the landing forces really happy, because if she's carrying the helicopters in her amphibious assault role instead of the Atlantic conveyor, then they actually have helicopters to move around instead of having to walk across the entirety of the blasted Falklands. But since nobody has actually really significantly upgraded her since her assault conversion role in the 50s, she's still got those quad 40mm Bofors, and, well, they've been nicely maintained, so why not? Well, some anti-aircraft defence is better than nothing. And then it turns out, of course, that short-range radar-guided quad 40mm Bofors are exactly the perfect thing to use in the confined waters of San Carlos as the various Argentinian aircraft come screaming past. At which point, somewhat implausibly, but also somewhat plausibly, she probably becomes one of the highest scoring anti-aircraft defense ships, because they take her forward to act as the amphibious assault vessel alongside Fearless. And when the A4s and the daggers come screaming down, well, yeah, the Seawolf has issues engaging, but this ship's covered in radar guided 40 millimeters, and she tears a bunch of Argentinian aircraft out of the sky. And sure, maybe the Argentinians drop a bomb or two on her, but come on, between the fact that early on their bombs weren't fusing properly and this thing was built by Brunel, do you think that's really going to trouble her? She probably comes home with a couple of new holes in the hull, but nothing much else to worry about. Which then, of course, ignites a whole load of controversy in the future, as various Argentine nationalists try to claim that, yes, in fact, they did manage to sink a converted 125-year-old iron Brunel era steamship, and the Royal Navy going, no, you didn't, because look, we got it as the museum over here, wherever it ends up. Nathan Redder asks, a couple of times I've heard the saying, the Navy floats on a sea of paper. Can you give us a crash course on naval admin? How long have yeomen been around? Advancement exams, evaluations, technical manuals, and various publications. I mean, that's several whole videos in and of itself, but very briefly, technical manuals and publications have actually been around a surprisingly long time. There are manuals of gunnery that go back to within a few decades of gunnery even being introduced on ships. So there's 1500s and 1600s eras manuals of gunnery, and some manuals of sailing as well. So obviously these things are not formally established in the way that they would be in the 20th century, with multiple editions being updated as time goes on. So very often you can find navigational or gunnery manuals that are 100, 150 years old, which are still mostly valid that time later. But obviously as time and technology accelerates, the issuing of such things also accelerates. As far as advancement exams go, the first lieutenant's examination for the Royal Navy was in 1677, if I recall correctly. So they've been going at least that long. But when it came to further advancement, there wasn't really any further advancement exams for a good long period, because essentially it was, you became a midshipman if you're going down the officer's route, and technically you were an officer, but you hadn't yet received a full and official commission. But once you passed that exam, you could then be commissioned as a lieutenant, and then you could start your climb in the ranks. But there wasn't, for the pretty much the age of sail, there wasn't a captain's examination board or such. Like, you tended to just get promoted either by seniority or due to meritorious conduct, or just because they needed somebody to captain a ship and you happened to be around. And then once you got to captain, whether or not you got to admiral was, again, just a matter of pure seniority and time passing, again, barring exceptional circumstances. Formal yearly evaluations or biannual evaluations, etc., again, are a very, very recent innovation in the grand scheme of things, and by the time period the channel covers, extremely recent. Because, again, in the age of sail, your evaluation to see whether or not you'd progress in rank would, again, as mentioned, be a combination of seniority and achievement, but nothing in terms of sitting an exam going, well, you are qualified to progress from lieutenant to captain. A lot of these more fixed ladders of evaluation and examination tend to crop up in the middle of the 19th century as the Navy becomes more and more technically focused and machine focused, and that's all navies, as opposed to, obviously, previously sail focused. About the closest you could find at that point would be where you have more captains than you have ships, and there may be some kind of admiralty board or admiralty meeting where they decide, okay, well, look, you know, we've got two commands coming up and eight captains we can choose from. Which two captains do we want to offer command of these vessels? But that's far more ad hoc, and it's not anything like the kind of formal exam you'd face to get a lieutenant's rank. It's a lot of the time just down to who you know and how much people like you. But yeomen, as in admin specialists, they've been around in one form or another since pretty much any significant size fleet sailed for any particular length of time. So, for example, the US Navy has yeomen pretty much as far back as the US Navy actually exists. Now, yes, I know officially the US Navy dates itself from the founding of the Continental Navy, but if you date the US Navy from when it was essentially reformed in the 1790s, yeomen are already there as a rank. But going back before that, and in some navies after that, you can have people who are doing a similar task, but going by different rank names. So, for example, the ship's clerk, who either might be a midshipman or he might have an assistant who's a midshipman, then, or the admiral's secretary, for example, these men would be doing a lot of paperwork. But also people like the ship's purser would be doing a fair amount of paperwork for stuff like the food supplies. And one of the reasons I've got this painting of Samuel Pepys up is because one of the things that Pepys is credited for, among various other things he did for the Navy, was not only having a little bit of a go at Royal Navy corruption, but also establishing a slightly clearer and more coherent line of admin and logistics and paperwork behind the front lines, as it were, which significantly upgraded the Royal Navy's capabilities because it meant that ships got maintained and tracked and traced and given the appropriate guns and orders and supplies a little bit more regularly than before, when it had been somewhat ad hoc. Gabriel A. Hawkins asks, one of the coolest photos ever is the Marine Angel meandering through downtown Chicago. Is there a warship equivalent to this, i.e. a warship photo of some size far, far upstream? I assume by definition Belfast is about as far as any major warship has made it up the Thames, and I know New Jersey once made a visit to Baton Rouge, and large warships have made it as far as Natchez, I think it is. Natchez, maybe? And there are instances, or are there instances, where substantial warships made it substantially further upstream. Well, yeah, in the case of Belfast, technically speaking, you could get a major warship fractionally further up the Thames, but not very much, because immediately upstream from Belfast is London Bridge, downstream is Tower Bridge, and of course Tower Bridge lifts, so you can get a major warship through it. London Bridge does not. So unless you have an extremely low-profile warship, that's about as far as you're getting. But in terms of major warships making it a long distance upriver, I mean, it really depends on the river, because you can get some very big rivers, and also when you're looking for in terms of major warships, because in the Age of Sail, for instance, a major warship at that point, let's say a third rate, can get significantly further up a river due to its smaller size and somewhat shallower draft than a big battleship could get in the 20th century, even if they are roughly equivalent in terms of use. So, for example, HMS London, trying to reach the Amethyst, and Amethyst herself, due to the twists and turns in the Yangtze River, probably about as far from the sea as a large warship making up to Natchez on the Mississippi. But then you also, you know, get definitions of what exactly is a substantial warship, because if you look at some of the gunboats and so forth that were built for various navies for specifically riverine operations, then in some cases you can get warships of reasonable armament operating up to 1,000 miles away from the coast. I mean, obviously the Marine Angel here is about 1,000 miles away from the coast in Chicago, but that's made somewhat easier by the presence of the Great Lakes. But it essentially comes down to how deep is the river and how shallow a draft is the warship, and at what point do you stop counting it as a substantial warship. If you've been a true ocean-going warship, then you're probably looking at maybe 300-400 miles as the crow flies as a maximum distance in. But once you get into ships that are specialized in riverine warfare, you can get a heck of a lot further. And finally for this week, Alfred Wilmore asks, could you briefly review your thoughts on the campaign mode of Ultimate Admiral Dreadnoughts? What does it do well, and where does it fail as far as providing context and consequences for in-game battles go? I would say, based on my somewhat limited experience of the campaign mode, as opposed to the custom battle mode, Ultimate Admiral Dreadnoughts generally does an okay job of simulating a naval campaign. I mean, you've got refits, you've got costs, you've got considerations of range and so forth. I would say my three largest issues with Ultimate Adult Dreadnoughts when it comes to the campaign mode come down more to do with the actual battles and the ships. And of course, the last time I played an Ultimate Adult Dreadnoughts campaign was a few patches before the final one. So they may have changed some of the elements of ship design and how the computer players work, etc. So if they have, and you've got more experience with that, please let me know in the comments below. But at the time that I was looking at it and playing it, I think my three main gripes would have been, one, ships unrealistically fight to the death. So if you have a sort of a minor fleet engagement, for example, if you've wiped out three quarters of the enemy fleet, by all logic, the surviving ships should either turn tail and run or surrender. But in some battles, it was a case of, hey, look, you know, my fleet's somewhat damaged, but I've managed to down 75-80% of the enemy fleet. But then the remaining 20%, even if it was a motley collection of, you know, the odd torpedo boat and a couple of cruisers, would still be maneuvering, trying to come in and attack me, which was a bit silly. Coupled with that, the damage model, certainly early on, and I think I may have raised this before, but the damage model was somewhat unrealistic. So I tried to play through one particular campaign, I remember, and I'd built a fleet that was based around kind of turn of the century pre-dreadnought tactics, and I was quite happy with it. And I went up in a battle against a fleet that was slightly more top heavy, but I wasn't too worried because I thought, okay, they've got one more battleship than me and a cruiser or two more, but they've only got two or three torpedo boats dash destroyers, and I've got about a dozen. So this should be a reasonable force balancer. And bear in mind, this is still the pre-dreadnought era. I hit one of the enemy battleships with two torpedoes out of a volley of six from a unit of three destroyers. I lost two of them to secondary battery fire and cruisers, but I thought, you know what, okay, that's annoying. I've lost two of my ships, but I've scored a couple of hits. That should at least be crippled. But it turns out two torpedo hits barely slowed the thing down, let alone, you know, came close to sinking it. And between those destroyers, additional destroyers, a couple of my cruisers and one of my battleships, I ended up hitting that ship with something in the order of 11 or 12 torpedoes. And all I managed to do was mildly inconvenience it. It was somewhat slower. Now, fair enough, that did slow it down enough that my remaining battleship then managed to finish it off with direct gunfire at close range. But still, there is no way on this planet any pre-dreadnought is eating nearly a dozen torpedoes and staying afloat. I mean, half that many, it should have been gone. But as I say, I do understand that they may have patched that since. But I think maybe I'll have to play another campaign with it now in its final patch mode and see what I think about it now. And that brings us to an end for this week's Dry Dock. Thank you very much for listening, everybody, and I hope to see you again in another video at some point soon. Next week, of course, is the Patreon Dry Dock, so have fun with that.